Hey, what up, this is Swamp Fiends. Coming back at you with another episode. Today, I have Andre from Texas to sit down and chat with me. How are you doing, Andre?
Hey, Cody. I'm doing okay. I'm having a nice, chill evening here. So, and I was happy to jump on and talk about one of my favorite things to do, one tricking.
Yeah. So today we're going to be talking about one tricking, which is a easy way to say it is just, you know, soloing a master in like an event, or, you know, kind of devoting your life and love to a single master. One tricking is like a term from video games, which I think is kind of appropriate for, you know, sort of the, my like speciality, but it's also kind of like, it's kind of like derogatory in a way that is like not serious. You know what I mean? Cause if you play League of Legends, you know about someone who's an Uter one trick, they're still famous for being an Uter one trick. You know what I mean?
Right.
Which I think is kind of the same connotation in Malifaux, where it's like, oh, that's that person that plays that, and they're very good with that. But it's still kind of funny that they play just that or something like that.
Right. Yeah. I like the idea that I'm the trick 2G of Nakima. I think I can get behind that concept, but
yeah. So I guess what is your credentials as a one trick then?
Well, I think I'm most famous for one tricking Nakima in like GG0, GG1. My most infamous success was LVO 2019, in which I played literally the exact same list for 5 rounds to take first. And that was Nakima with Inhuman Reflexes back when it was Butterfly Jump. 2 Ancient Pack Matures, Harridan with the Butterfly Jump upgrade as well, and then a Shaman and 7 Stones. And I just rode that into the ground, and it's all I ever played for like the first 6 or 7 months once I honed that list down. And it worked. Like, it hit hard, it was mobile, it was for in its own way tanky. And so, like, it did everything I needed it to do. And so that's what made one tricking it both a joy and possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's what we're going to talk about, is just sort of like, where do you find advantages doing this kind of thing? And where do you find disadvantages? I wanted to talk about this because it's something that I've kind of never done. When I first got into the game, I kind of one tricked Hamlin because I played Parker and then realized Hamlin was just Parker, but better at everything in second edition. So I just played nothing but Hamlin for a while. So I'm kind of hoping you can sell me on the experience of being a one trick on something, just so that I can try that out. And I feel like it's got to be a fun learning exercise in certain ways. That in my brain, especially lately, because I've been dealing with a lot, I've been painting like crazy. So I have like 3 fully painted factions at this point. Wow. So my brain immediately goes to like, whenever I think about any matchup, I immediately go to like, okay, what's the crew I could play in 3 different factions? And I feel like I need to swing the pendulum back the other way. So I guess the first question is, why do you find one tricking fun?
To me, the fun of one tricking is forcing yourself to learn how to utilize models differently than they might normally be intended in their best role. And I mean that in kind of like a, you know, I can't think of, you know, like Mongolian restaurants, right? Where they hearken to the days of like, you know, they used their shields to cook. And when you're like, well, you look at a shield, you're not thinking cooking implement. But, you know, when you start to have to cook and you got shields around, you try to make it work. And so in that same kind of vein, right, when you are forced to use models by your own hand to try and accomplish different objectives than you might intend them to be for, you start to learn new avenues of how to accomplish your objectives. And I think, at least for me, a recent example of that is Maxine 1 for me, because I've been one-tricking Maxine 1 a lot recently. She's fun to play, and I like her, and she's got a lot of adaptability, which I think is actually a key component for one-tricking. But most of the time, before I've, you know, played into Maxine's and watched her being used, I never saw the gun being used, but I crave damage. And so when I started trying to, you know, hit all the nails with my hammer. I was like, all right, let's just use this gun. Like, you know, impromptu invention's cool and all, and, you know, handing Kaya a couple of focus here and there is rad. But what if I just, you know, kept shooting downrange to put damage downrange? And it works. It works beautifully. But it's not what people look at Maxine's card and say, oh, well, clearly she's just going to be cocking and blasting all game. And so for me, it kind of takes those models that you know, when you say like, oh, dude, I definitely need conditions on these models in order to win the game. Obviously, Maxine fits that role with impromptu invention. But if you only ever play to what you think their greatest strengths are, you don't see the adaptability behind the rest of the card. And I think to me, that is the fun of one tricking, is getting so intimately familiar with a crew that you can find what they're 80% good at instead of 100% good at and use that in the right scenarios. And to me, that's a really fulfilling part of kind of unlocking a crew's potential as you play it in situations where you think they wouldn't be very good.
Yeah, it's funny you mention Maxine. She's one of the only masters I've played every round of a tournament in 3E. And that's exactly what happened on. So I stacked conditions the first two rounds, and then in round three, I just turn one went blasting with their guns. So interesting, kind of similar experience there. But it sounds like I feel like when you think about fun, a lot of it with a tabletop minis game is you're thinking about like, where's the skill narrative? You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like where can you say I was influential in the result of the game? And it sounds like when you're one tricking, the narrative that you're spinning is I thought of this completely corner case thing that I hadn't thought of before. And that was really rewarding. So that's kind of true.
Yeah, no, that is definitely where it starts to come in. It's those, like I said, it's the moments where you use the cards in a way that you don't immediately expect them to be used. I faced similar issues with Nakima as an example, where like Nakima can kill a lot of things, but she can't kill everything. You don't have those games where you figure out what she can and can't run from and can and can't deal with until you just keep putting reps down on the table. And so a lot of the times what one tricking does is it lets you learn what engagements you can and cannot take, and when to take them where necessary. Because as an example, like Hoffman is not something Nakima can deal with, but it's like, can she go into a Pandora? Cause Pandora hits her with her own sword and that's really scary. But then you start to learn like, well, if there's a lot of concealing terrain, I can get into that. But until you start, kind of digging into those problems firsthand, the theory craft doesn't necessarily back up what you see on the table until you actually get in and start using all of the tools you have at your disposal when you have to. And I think another part of it is, for me, the fun of one tricking is that I have left most of my thought out of the pregame phase, right? Like that initial 5-minute rush where you're like, hi, my name is Andre. I'm never born. All right, cool. I'm declaring Nakima.
Yeah.
All right, cool. Here's my list. I have no thoughts running through my head at that point. And it's a nice clean slate to be able to say, I know exactly how my turn one's going to go. I know exactly the distances I need to be at to get these things done. And I don't have to think about it, which means I can spend more time analyzing what my opponent's actually doing and respond to that as opposed to having to play against myself. Because as an example, like I don't think anybody just like says, you know, Hamlin feels like the right call here and just like drops him on a round three one time. Like that's a dude that you need to have absolute proficiency in order to get all five rounds in and understand the rat engine and yeah. or when to not do that. Like all of that is only decisions you can make when you have at least, you know, 2 to 3 dozen games of Hamlin under your belt. And the only way to get those games in, frankly, is to one trick, in my opinion. Like nobody has 40 hours a week to devote to Malifaux. So at some point, if you want to get that good at a master, you need to put in the reps. And in order to do that, one tricking is absolutely the way.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from. I think in terms of like what's often the most fun for me is coming up with a weird combo, and then on turn two or turn three, my opponent's like, "Oh, this is bullshit." You know, they're like, "Oh, I see how this works now." You know, that's kind of the most fun thing for me, but. Because of that, I often, do too much in list creation. I lost a game on Saturday because I was like trying to come up with some weird counters and then put stuff in. And then it's like, oh, that's not how this works.
Yeah.
But I'm not fully on that end. You know, like Maeve is probably someone who plays a different list every single game. I think I'm kind of in between. It's why I play against myself so much. I really don't understand things until I see them on the table. Mm-hmm. So I think I'm kind of in the middle in terms of a one trick versus an innovator, which reminds me of this video I saw the other day about like fighting games where mm-hmm. there's like two different stylistic, you know, dispositions where certain people are owners and certain people are innovators. I actually is probably comes from chess more than anything. Where, you know, the honers really like to practice and they really like to get good at the micro interactions. And then the innovators like to try weird shit and see what they can get away with. I think you would probably consider yourself in the former category, right?
I hadn't really beforehand, but I do now. So if I'm being honest with myself, I like to play things that are just like a little bit snowflakey. Like,
yeah.
Because for me, like, I understand that Hoffman 2 and Yanlo 2 and Mayfang are strong, or Terra for that matter. I understand that those are all strong masters, and in the absence of a meta, I might find them interesting. But because everyone is playing them, it turns me off to playing them as well. And I fully admit this, that I'm snowflakey, but like, I want to do something that people don't see coming necessarily, and then playing that to the nth degree, where it's, for yeah. me, it's part of the aesthetic of my win. Is to say, well, I didn't think that was very strong, but I lost to it anyway. Ergo, Andre must be a strong player or something to that effect. And so
now I'm in the same boat. That's why I like dual masters and I play them so often. It's not because I think they're exceptionally good. It's because no one else is playing them.
Right.
So I feel like I can play them a bunch and do well and play the strong ones and, but also get away with kind of dark horsing and kind of playing off meta.
Yeah, and I think that's a ton of fun. And so, but in order to get to that point, I feel like with the Dark Horse picks, if they have like, you know, 85 or 80% of the power of what is the strongest thing in the meta, in order to make up for those, you know, being behind on the meta players, you need to be really, really good at your craft of whatever you're one-tricking in order to have that edge. And I think in order to do that, you really got to hone in and focus on it. So to that extent, I am a honer. I will agree with that. But I think there's at least at the beginning a little bit of an innovator in that I don't want to play what the strongest thing is and then just hone that to the best I can. I want to pick my special snowflake sauce kind of master and then come at that with that kind of dark horse angle with the best thing I can possibly do. Because I think a lot of losing or winning Malifaux comes down to being able to do things that the opponent doesn't expect and being able to anticipate what the opponent will do. And that becomes a lot easier to obfuscate if people aren't intimately familiar with what your crew's capable of.
Yeah, I mean, I actually thought about doing an episode on this, but it would be too like ranty or something. Where when you get down to it, and you, in all things, are equal. What actually is competition? What actually is skill? Is and this isn't just in Malifaux. It's in kind of like any competitive thing. Is mm-hmm. prediction. I believe that's kind of like what is the soul of competition is predicting your opponent when you make everything else equal. So in some ways I am hesitant to be sort of like a one trick because I'm like, well, that makes me predictable. But then innovation sort of doesn't stop at list creation and all the pregame steps, list selection and stuff like that. Scheme selection.
Right.
You're still innovating in the game in some ways. And that goes back to your first point where you said you found it fun to sort of innovate on the table rather than before it.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that is where the kind of dodging the prediction comes in, right? And this phenomena I observed at least lightly back in the GG1, GG0 era of Nakima's heyday, is that I had, after my success at LVO, I had a lot of imitators, at least locally. Everyone was like, oh, dude, Nakima must just be OP. So like two or three of the local guys in Houston started just putting down game after game of Nakima, thinking that they would just, you know, naturally rise to the top. And they couldn't make it work. They couldn't figure out what I was doing that they weren't, that made me competitive in that way. And if I'm being honest, I think truly the issue is, you know, picking your engagements and absolutely correct positioning, which is a skill that I carry over into my other cruises I play, because basically what it taught me is how to gauge what someone's threat range is, and then play around that as best as you possibly can, because at least for Nephilim specifically, like if you pick the wrong engagement, you die. And so you have to be absolutely sure who you want to reach game, who you want to bleed on, who you want to avoid entirely, you know, who do you want to keep chewing on, or who do you want to shove aside into some severe terrain and then go deal with later. And so, cause those are all questions that if you get wrong as a Nephilim, you die. And so I picked those skills up, and that was kind of what they were missing, is because they just saw 3-5-6 damage track and a bunch of focus, and they were like, oh, he's winning because he just YOLOs at the biggest thing until it dies, and then I win. And I think that is kind of the level of honing that even, I mean, obviously I was famous for being in Nakima one trick, but there were plenty of people that knew it and planned for days on how to beat me. And they were just like, oh, I didn't expect him to play that way that he did, or take out the models that he did. And that cost me. And so it kind of, their, in a way, their expectations about how they thought I would play because I was in Nakima main, caused their predictions to be false, despite the fact that I was in Nakima main. So I still think there's a lot of room, even in being, quote, predictable with being the one trick. Now, obviously, there are people that, you know, Hoffman, too, these days can just be like, yep, cool. I picked right and Nakima's going to die. But it, at least pre-Burns, I think there was a lot of room to be able to finagle around people's expectations, even as a one trick, even if they know exactly model for model what crew you're bringing, because that was true for the longest time, and still be able to come out ahead.
Yeah, and I mean, that comes down to play style. I've always thought that when something feels OP to you, that probably means it's your play style more than the developers messed up. That sound okay?
Do I feel
your robot?
No, you're good. You're good. I'm thinking about what you're saying though. Like,
yeah, but so like I mean, I get DMs from people all the time that are like, you know, I'm really interested in playing, you know, Levy. I'm really interested in playing Terra, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, I've played the game 5 times and I'm afraid it's going to like destroy my meta. My advice usually is like, well, don't care about meta health. Play something that you think will fit your playstyle. And if it doesn't, you're going to lose regardless of how overtly strong it is. In the case of Nakima, I think... you know, like in this case, it's something that fits your, it's strong because it fits your play style. I mean, I think what you're basically saying to me is that like your biggest strength is target selection, because I think you're like a fairly analytical player. You know your opponent's models really well. Mm-hmm. That's not me. I don't know my opponent's models very well. so like target selection is like your biggest skill. So you've worked your way backwards from that, where you have Nakima who can kind of go wherever. And then the rest of the list builds back out from, you know, well, when I get there, I'm going to get initiative. So I'm going to have last activation turn 1, first activation turn 2 with the double HE pack, blah, blah, blah. And I can really put a lot of resources into what I assess to be like the most important thing.
Yes.
I'm like different stylistically. Like I play a lot of like scramble list. Like the lists I like the most are the ones that cause you to like, oh, wait, what? Like, just sort of mess with your order of activations. You know, that's why I play with Terra so much. Mm-hmm. You know, mess with your activation control states like that, just so that I can see you telegraph something, and then I want to go in for like a knockout punch. You know, I'm sort of like a, you know, like a scrappy, like in the pocket boxer, and you're more of a scalpel, even though I'm using mixed metaphors there.
right.
So yeah, I think in terms of honing, it makes sense that, you know, once you find something that fits your play style, then you can start to really get good at those types of, you know, building your list out from what fits that and scheme selections. But if you're playing too many things, you know, sort of chasing the meta, you're never going to get to that point.
Yeah, and I think to touch on a couple points you mentioned here, first off, if... that thing you played for four or five games seems really strong and you are to the point that you're afraid it will destabilize the stability of your local meta, I don't know if that's a good meta. I don't know. I loathe the idea that people play into something that they lost into once and felt unfair, and then just like, well, it's OP and I can't do anything to stop it. Guess I'll quit playing. I mean, I understand that there are people like that out there, but I don't know if I would consider them the healthiest parts of the meta if that is how it is. Like, if you can only ever play the three things they're kind of understand, I don't know if those kind of people are showing up to tournaments, you know what I mean? But yeah. Beyond that point, the idea that you have, you know, the kind of the play style that you play to, I think there's a lot of things that you pick up in a play style that can easily transfer to things that don't make sense. Like, I fully believe that my skills with positioning and scalping with Nakima transferred to Maxine, even though there are two very, very different crews. And I think a lot of that understanding that and how to apply those skills, once again, just ties back into, I put Maxine on the table enough and understood that I could put those skills to use if I played her a certain way. And so I think that, you know, giving crews that might not sound like your initial cup of tea actually ends up panning out quite well. Even though it sounds like the play style might be different. And so I guess I'm just taking this moment to say, if you think something might not be up your alley, give it a couple of tries anyway and see if it ends up having more than met the eye initially.
I think even with Maxine, like you were talking about how, you know, you played to her gun, which is basically the target selection version of Maxine. Yeah. One. It's like, a master with leap in a range 12 gun. Hell yeah. Probably scalpel whatever the hell I want out of there. Yes. But yeah, to your point, I mean, that doesn't mean that like, you know, if you play something 2-3 times, you got it down pat. That's obviously not true.
Right. Yeah.
And to your first point about the meta health thing, my point is like, I mean, also to kind of continue your point about how, like, if a person is up in arms about something being too strong, that could be detrimental to the meta or whatever. You can kind of be, I also really take issue when people are like, oh, I played this one thing and I won with it and it's bad for my meta, because that's kind of like, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this delicately. But like, when you're like a teenager and, you know, you're going through puberty, your first interactions with a lot of people can be overly sort of like, attached and concerned and like, you know, wanting to stand outside the balcony reciting poetry to like an 11-year-old girl or something, you know what I mean? And like, in retrospect, as like an adult, you know, the main way to like attract people in relationships is to have fun with them. And if you're in playing tabletop games, is kind of the same. Where, like, if you're playing with, you know, your new player or whatever, and you're apologizing every time you kill a model, and you're saying, oh, this is really bad, you know, sorry for doing this. They're saying on the internet, this is really strong. You know, I feel bad for you. And that kind of stuff is kind of the same, where you're like, you're not having fun with the person, even if you're beating them or killing their models or something. And if, like, you take a step back and it's like, all right, let's, you know, oh, I just killed your bottle. I flipped Red Joker. That was awesome. You know, I think that goes a lot further in terms of improving meta health than going on the forums and complaining about how.
Yeah. You know, or like, models ever found. You know, when people try new things or like, oh, man, this looks really cool, I want to play it. And it ends up being strong. I feel like the duty of the rest of the community on some level is to kind of rise to the occasion, right? Like, I don't want people to feel shamed for wanting to be good or strong at a game. Like, to me, that is the antithesis of a competitive spirit. Because it's like, oh man, you beat me so bad, feels bad. Like that, because to me, it gives you like a new goalpost to hit, where it's like, oh dude, yeah, my local guy's now playing Hoff 2. I got to figure out how to top it. Like, even if I feel like it's you know, strong or busted or whatever. Like, I felt that way about Shtook and GG Zero. It was like, this dude has so many tools in his kit, it is stupid. I'm going to figure out how to beat him. And I feel like that is the spirit that people need to be able to approach the game with, because that way everybody in that community can kind of come together over the idea of getting better at the game and dealing with these specific things, and not making people feel bad for taking those things to a tournament or whatever and being like, all right, I'm going to try and win as hard as I can, and you try to win as hard as you can. Let's go. Like, you know, I understand the, you know, the aesthetics of win to a certain degree, but like, at some point, winning is the aesthetic for some people. And so, and I don't want to push those people away, because I think that's what makes like a stronger community to begin with. But like I said, you know, obviously I'm very much on the tournament side of things and competition and things like that. You know, so if you're your average Joe coming in for a Tuesday every other weekend, or every other week, just trying to, you know, get a game in before you go home for the day. Like, I understand that like getting your teeth kicked in doesn't feel great. But I don't think, if the only other guy that showed up was the competitive player, I don't think it's his fault that you were playing a game in which there is a winner and a loser and you lost.
Well, I don't think you need to break it down in terms of competitive versus casual. I think it's just good form to, like, you know, at a certain level, at least some level, you're friends with the person you're playing with, and you know, it's good to sort of root them on, and at, you know, it's like, oh man, they got this crazy list and it's brutal. I'm gonna have to figure something out. You know, like that's like good form in terms of how you play tabletop games.
And it's gratifying to have white whales and to be white whale. Like, there was a guy in the Texas community named Travis. And I couldn't take a game off the guy no matter what I did. I had the same experience later where I had people who spent like months at a time trying to beat my Nakima list in the day. And that to me felt good, because that was like, I like being public enemy number one, and I liked having a public enemy number one for me. And so it ended up building like a lot of community and camaraderie where, you know, the kind of the huff and the puff as you get up to the table, like, oh man, I got matched into Travis. Let's see how this goes. And to me, that's one of the most fun parts of being in a community of Malifaux. And I want other people to be able to kind of taste that as well, I think.
Yeah, there's a guy in North Carolina who I only beat once, and that's because I got lucky and killed his master turn two. So I was like, and he beat me probably 9 times outside of that. So, but he taught me so much about play style and things, just seeing things differently. That was, you know, sort of atypical from a lot of things. And even to this day, it's fun to think about like what he was doing differently that wasn't like list writing or card management or something. It was like stylistically and positioning and sort of like the way he took trades. It's like, that's fun to think about in retrospect. But just to sort of bring it back to the topic of honing, I think the one thing that kind of makes me skeptical about hesitant in terms of like being like, okay, I'm going to commit, you know, 20 games to this master is, you know, on game 4, if I've played the same guy 3 times, and I've won all 3 games, you know, maybe, I start to feel bad. So I think that's why this topic is kind of related, because, it can feel weird to be like, okay, you're playing against Zoraida 1 again. You happy? And they're like,
yeah.
No. Yeah. But I don't know. It is sometimes hard to draw the line between what is unfun and then what is just good.
Yeah. Well, and I think for all games, like regardless of context, like setting your expectations for how you want this game to feel and turn out is important. I've watched a lot of D&D YouTube videos where it's like, set the expectations for your game before you sit down. And I feel like that's going to be the same way, just to avoid that kind of dissonance in a Malifaux casual game that is, you know, your weekly game where it's like, hey, you know, this is the crew I own, so I'm going to play it. And then, you know, yeah, the other guy who's like, well, I bought all these Leviticus models and, you know, that's the hot stuff right now, so I'm going to try and break you off as hard as I can. Like, well, obviously.
That's a good point. So when you are one tricking, like, do you feel like it is, it does make the experience for your local group a little easier if you're saying, hey, by the way, I'm playing my list. You pick the pool, or like, you know, you pick whatever you want to play into this. Do you feel like stuff like that goes a long way?
I do. And I think it helps them get more into the decision making for the game than kind of the pregame panic. Because they know when I, you know, sit down at a game, you know, in the last 2 months, they're gonna be like, all right, cool. I know he's bringing Maxine One. I know he's bringing these X models. And that's not really going to change. I just need to figure out how to play my crew as best I can, into that. And I know how his previous matchups went to try and make this game better. And so while that isn't giving them more diverse combat data, it is giving them the repetitions they need to perhaps play me at my best. And then at the same time, I'm also learning stuff every game. And so we're kind of, you know, reaching the nth degree of the matchup each time we go into it. Cause I have a local guy that's been playing VIX 2 for the last couple of months. And so we generally understand like what the key turning points of the game are, where it's like, if I can drop his Ronin, he's going to have trouble scoring. If he can drop my Machinist, I have trouble healing. And so like we understand those parts of the matchup well enough. And you can make the argument that we're staling out, I guess, but I think for the most part, it's leaving all the overhead out of the way and letting us just focus on, you know, scoring the points and playing a clean game. And I think that has a lot of value that carries over, even when you want to jump to a different crew. Keeping you in the same mindset of like, where are my points? I don't really need to think about the rest of this. Once you get, you know, back into a comfortable groove with the next crew, I think those are more kind of transcendental skills to learn. And so a lot of that I think comes from playing games where you don't have to think about of like, oh, what's that trigger do, what's this guy do, like leaving all that to the side and just being like, I know what your models do, I know what my models do, let's play a game.
I think that's a pretty good segue into talking about sort of the downsides, because when you're when your opponent knows you're playing the same list every day, do you ever feel like overly tech to the point where you're like, well, now I'm not having a good time or anything like that? And do you feel like that's a thing that you run into fairly frequently, where people are like counter hiring you more than is realistic, considering like what the only information they should have is your faction going into list creation? You know what I mean?
Right.
Going into master declaration.
I definitely had issues with that towards the end of my Nakima heyday, I played into a dude, Shanti's his real name, but Maniacal Cackle Online, in which we had a game on Vassal where he literally built a crew for the map. There was like this little nook on one of the maps that we played where he could keep Sheamus covered by an Ashigaru to teleport and shoot things. And then like, you know, had the rest of the crew kitted perfectly to ruin my day, specifically knowing exactly what I was going to bring. And that felt real bad. That no other way around that. It felt real bad. And so for the most part though, I don't think you're going to have that kind of problem in a real world setting, at least for what I've seen so far in like you know, like an Adepticon or a Gen Con or whatever. Most of the time people pre-plan their lists around what they're trying to score and will have like a couple of models they might switch out, depending on what they feel like the matchup's going to be. Like in a Neverborn crew, if they really feel like their opponent's going to hand them a bunch of conditions they don't want, you might see a Serena hire, but they're not going to be like, all right, cool, here's this tricked out crew that I built to counter you specifically because I've heard about you. Doesn't really happen that often. And a lot of the times that just comes down to, because no one consistently has the ability to bring an entire faction to every con they go to. You know, you'll have your, you know, overhead storage bin that stored your two or three keywords you want to play. And then you have the idea to bring those keywords far before you ever know what your opponent is. And then at the most, you have like 5 to 10 minutes to be like, all right, cool, he's playing this, so I need to bring Laugh Off or whatever. So I think that Vassal shows the worst excesses of getting specifically countertech, because you have literal days to think about the matchup. And so you'll see a lot of that there, but for real world stuff, I mean, unless it's like a local guy that was just had my number and wanted it. I haven't had to deal with that at a convention. Even where people knew who I was and I didn't know who they were. The tech that they brought was not such that I couldn't try to best them anyway. But I will say that the idea of getting used to a list at least lets you play it better, even if you're bringing your vanilla flavored crew. Because my school of thought has infected my local meta, So I liked one trick, and now most of the people that I play with locally like to one trick. Like, we got a Brew one trick, a Dashel 2 one trick, a Vix 2 one trick. And they've just been, you know, they found a master that they think can handle most things, and then try to play them as well as they can, because it worked for me, so ergo it must work. And I will say, for the most part, it's actually working out pretty well. I will say that they've definitely come a long way competitively because of it. But that does mean, to a certain extent, that when, you know, the Dashel 2 player puts his crew down on the table, I know for a fact he's taking Dashel 2 with a coat, an executioner with a coat, a sergeant with expert shot, and a couple of mounted guard. Like, I know that that's what he's bringing. And so what that does lead into on a negative side is, when you play a Dashel 2 in the wild, you have no idea what that dude's bringing. And for me, that happens a lot on Vassal, where I'm like, oh, okay, he's playing Maxine. So these are the five things he's going to bring, because we all play in keyword down here, and someone hires Winston Finnegan. I'm like, why? Why would you hire that model? It's not the six models I expect you to hire when you play this master. And so it can kind of cut the wrong grooves in the long term. If you're playing, away games a lot, I guess is how I'd describe it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I definitely have had the experience where people will DM me blah, blah, blah is taking this into this pool. What is he going to do? And I'll be like, oh, I know exactly. He's taking these two schemes. He's taking this. If you kill that on turn two, you're basically going to win. And then they'll write me back 2 days. Like, yeah, I got stomped. He just ran at me and it flipped good or something. Okay, well, sorry for giving you advice. So I think what is also another downside is you miss out on some easy wins in the earlier rounds of a tournament. Like, say you're going to a 5-round tournament. Mm-hmm. I think it probably one tricking probably makes you, I don't know, if I had to guess, I'd say you're probably relative to someone who's not doing that, you're probably the most strong in round one and round four or something. Mm-hmm. Because, round five, you should be playing someone who knows what you're doing. You know, that's when you're going to get tech the most. And then round two or three, that's crazy territory. And then round one is everyone's getting their shit together still. And you're the most honed. So you're best at unpack and da 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 da. But I feel like if you're one tricking, you probably miss out on some easy wins. I definitely get easy wins at pretty much every tournament I go to, because I just have thought through a faction matchup so much, where it's like, no matter what they drop, I got some weird dual mastery list that will stomp that shit out. If they don't know to do this and this, da 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 da. And based off that kind of theory, I sort of think that the best one trick masters are ones that should reliably get you the win against, let's say, the X and two player who might take a win off you if you didn't mitigate certain variables. Mm-hmm. And by that, I mean, it seems like generalists who can mitigate some jokers, who can draw some cards, who can usually take some focus attacks to really exploit mispositioning from a relatively weaker player. Those feel like sort of the stronger one tricks to me. Does that track?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. I think for me, one tricking is predicated on the idea that you have most of the tools that you need in a kit to be able to deal with anything passably. I couldn't play, let me think about this. Nelly isn't someone I could one trick, because sometimes you got to kill people, and Nelly can theoretically put out some damage, and Fiona's fine, I guess. But for the most part, the crew in her keyword is not just dropping bodies, right? And so for me, that's a tool that, at least personally, I really need to be able to reach for when I need it. And she don't got it. And there's other examples of that where it's this, Dashel 2 is actually a contentious pick for me, because his crew, other than his rifleman, which I wouldn't write home about, don't really deal with armor hardly at all. So when you play into an armor 2 crew, you're basically hoping they don't have the metallurgist, and then you spend a win, hopefully, to just melt through their armor instead of actually punching it. And so for me, being able to punch through armor or deal with, you know, terrifying or manipulative or whatever the case may be, the common technologies that you'll see on the table. If you can't deal with those, that's a problem. And if you can't find your cards, or at least be able to cope with not having good cards, that's a problem. And so to me, in order to be a good one-trickable crew, you have to have answers for those situations in order for me to really consider them to be a one-trick option, which is like, you know, before Hoffman had ways to deal with Black Blood, I was like, okay, Nikima has some sauce. Like, she pretty much, no matter what matchup she goes into, like, she has a way to try and do what she needs to do and get points and get stuff done. And I feel the same way with the next two one tricks that I did, which was McCabe and Maxine, where they have those same kinds of tools in the pocket where it's like, yep, I've got card manipulation, I can deal with armor, and I have the ability to run schemes in a vacuum. And all of those, I think, are important tools in a kit to be able to call it one-trickable, because I would not one-trick with everyone. Like, I wouldn't one-trick with Pandora or Nelly or even, like, Perdita or Justice, because at the end of the day, there are matchups that, A, they just hate. Like, they're just things that they can't deal with and need a different hire. And at that point, I'm having to reinvest my mental capital into a whole other crew for a specific scenario, and that's what I'm trying to avoid, right? Is that reinvestment into a whole different crew that might not see things until it's too late. So to go back to the, I didn't expect you to hire that model because it's the same six models that I expect you to hire kind of deal. It's, they're going to play this certain way, so I need to bring this model to be able to counter that. And then I don't even hire that model. You're like, all right, so what do I do? And to me, one tricking solves that problem by just being like, well, you know, I expected to have to deal with, you know, Terra's enforcers with Kaya, but it's not like Kaya doesn't have other uses that I can put her to if those models aren't on the table. Whereas if you get caught up in counter teching and the tech that you expected to counter just isn't there, it can throw you off your game immediately. So as long as you hit like the big three, which is card manipulation, armor punching, and terrifying manipulative tech, you can pretty much do anything you need to do as long as you have some form of ability to get across the board and take interact actions.
An example of the opposite would be, I've played a fuck ton of Terra, but I would never dream of one tricking her because, like, back in, like, I guess let's say pre Terra 2, Terra 1, like, I don't want to run into a rogue zip player who will, you know, like an X2 zip player who's going to just draw a bunch of severes, and that's going to be lights out for me. I'm not going to be able to get any of my engine running or anything like that. Even though Terra is incredibly strong into like very skilled players, there could be it. She doesn't do a lot to make things safe. And I feel like one of the things you need out of a one trick is to be like, your benefit will always be that, like, I know this matchup better than you. And I know that if you put, and I know that I care about that model a whole lot. And if I kill it on turn two, I basically win. And if you put that model 7 inches from the biggest threat to me, and that's a walk and a charge away, and that means I'm good to go. I can bring my take my focus over there. I can kill it on turn two, and because you're a walk charge away instead of just a charge away, that's basically going to win me the game. So I feel like the main thing you're looking for in like a one trick is to be able to exploit your micro knowledge.
Yes.
While in Terra, like for example, like knowing that exploitable thing often wouldn't matter because it's like, what am I going to do? Just run across the board and min three you? That's not my play. That's not what this crew does. It's not its advantage. So I think that's what you're looking for when deciding what's one trickable.
Yeah, I think the kinds of play that one tricking opens your eyes up to is the ugly play. Because everybody has their plan for when things go beautifully. It was like, yes, I have my pair of kings in hand, and here's this sphere, and I have connected, here's my focus, here's six damage, glorious victory. But one tricking forces you into the eventuality of the other half of the bell curve, where you're like, all right, cool, I've stoned for cards, and I have an eight high, I don't know what I'm going to do. Those kind of messy turns, once you get experience with those, and have those kind of games under your belt, understanding what a crew does from behind in a card perspective is a completely different game. Because obviously, if Nakima's got her fat hand of Severs, yeah, she can yellow in and kill something and feel great about it. But when you have the eight high hand, you're like, all right, what do I do when I don't know if anything's going to pass? And no one plans for that. No one's like, ah, yes, when Terra starts her activation on turn two and I have eight high, here's exactly what the play is going to be that I make. And so, the one tricking lets you get all of the greatest expanse of situations that suck, and then being able to play from behind in those situations and then keeping moving forward. Or like a lot of times, I'll play into players who, if they lose their master on turn two, they just concede. If you never sit down and like, well, points is prizes, I got to stick it out, I'm going to be here for this. In a casual game, you'll just be like, all right, cool, I scoop, let's go grab dinner. But one tricking in a competitive tournament, you're like, well, McCabe's not here anymore, and the rest of us are going to have to mourn later. And in those scenarios, you learn more about the models, what you have left, and how you do in that kind of terrible scenario. And that kind of information is useful to you later, even when you aren't in that sucky situation. Just because you're like, well, I know that if I hand my Rough Rider the sword, it's actually going to do a lot more damage to that guy than I really thought about it, because I had never intended to use the model in this way until I had to, and now I've learned something. So to me, those are the kinds of avenues the one tricking opens up.
Yeah, every deck has basically a certain amount of damage that's in it, regardless of what models are on the table. Just because you're that far behind, they only have so many Severs in their deck, so it can be, it's useful to figure out, how you can take advantage of what you got, for sure. So I guess just to sort of timestamp this episode, GG3 just came out like 2 days ago or something like that. And Malifaux Burns came out, I don't even know how many months ago.
Gen Con last year, so almost.
No way.
Almost 11.
Lies. Oh, wow. Okay. So at this point in time, what do you think are some of the most one-trickable masters floating around if someone's wanting to pick up something and really dedicate some time to it?
Well, I can obviously state that I think Maxine's very one-trickable. We've talked about her a lot, though. I would say beyond that, you're looking for crews that have mobility, card draw, tank, and damage, which obviously are all things we all want, but some crews have them and some crews don't. So I would say like Von Stuck is a good example. Like he's got speedy models, he's got card draw, he's got annoying tech to deal with all the stunning and hard wound and armor everywhere. And obviously with that, he has the survivability. So to me, he's kind of the gold standard of a one trickable master, because whatever the situation is, he's got something he can try to do to answer it. And even some unique tech to go along with it. Like there's a lot of matchups that get really warped with like academic superiority as an example. And so when you know how to leverage those kinds of things really well, the one trick's power really stands out, I would say, because obviously anyone could just apply valedictorian to the forehead, but deciding which forehead to apply her to and when to go in, brings a lot of value. And that value, in my opinion, is most accrued with one tricking. Other stuff like that though, is going to be stuff. I actually think McCabe too, obviously. I mean, I one tricked him at Adepticon and brings a lot of the same values that Stuck brings, less on the tanky side. But his card manipulation is disgusting. He can fight pretty much anything he needs to. And he's got wonderful, wonderful scheme runners in the crew, as well as, I mean, Drogamo are obviously not in his keyword, but they're his favorite playthings, in my opinion. And they crush teeth if you can hand them fast and a lightsaber. And so those are the kinds of things that I look for, where the strong card manipulation, the ability to get up the board and ask questions that people struggle to answer at least 60% of the time, and then being able to adapt to whatever question they're trying to ask you.
So you think being good at more matchups is more important than being good at all the pools?
Yes, because Colette can be the greatest, you know, symbols runner to play the game, although thankfully that's not relevant anymore. But if she just, you know, if you're playing into someone that just unburies you and you die, that's, it doesn't really matter how good she is at the pool. If someone can just grab you by the throat and kill you. And so it's stuff like that, that, makes me concerned with, you know, as an example, like I would be absolutely terrified of a Colette one trick for sure. And there are certainly players that I've known that are very, very, very good at Colette, to make that scary. But there are some things at the end of the day that Colette can't deal with. And I find that loathsome, to one trick. And so I think in the same way, you need to be able to answer as many questions as possible with a one trick, or you're going to feel bad. Or, I mean, you can just accept that there are matchups that you're just going to get bodied in, and then you just hope they never come up. But as soon as you get develop, and that'll work fine at away games, because most of the time people should not be infamous for one tricking a certain thing at away cons. Most people are not on podcasts talking about their favorite one trick. So, shouldn't be a problem for most people. But if you start one tricking locally and it gets bodied by a specific thing, then your local competitive players will be like, all right, cool. He's playing Brewmaster. I brought Divine Strike. He loses. And I think that finding things that aren't easily countered is probably one of the biggest deals. Cause no one sits down to a game and playing into McCabe 2, like, I have brought this one thing and now he loses. It's not really a thing. And the same way with Maxine, and as I will continue to harp on, before Malifaux Burns, I felt the same way about Nakima. She always had at least something of an answer to everything, even if people were just trying to the nth degree, to counter her in a real space setting. And I think that to me is the most important marker of a one-trickable crew. So if you feel like you can deal with armor or deal with people trying to avoid the fight or deal with having to dive bomb across the board to score symbols or whatever it is going to be these days, having those answers readily available no matter what your crew is going to be, to me, more important than the pools themselves. Because obviously, I play the same thing regardless of pool. The matchup to me is the most important.
All right, so here's what I'm thinking that I would one-trick. You tell me which one I should do. Zoraida, I like both versions. That's what's appealing to me. Yanlo 2 is incredibly fun and flexible. Nexus 2, I feel like is very powerful, and especially in the new GG. And, oh, Terra, just because she's stupid in the current GG, I think, and can cause people to tilt off the planet.
No kidding. Although Zoraida has much the same power, at least.
Yeah.
That I've seen. I think of those four, I would say, at least for me personally, I find Zoraida the most entertaining option of the four. I think she's got good card manipulation, and oftentimes crews that are good at something are good at beating that something as well. At least I've found that to be true for Hoffman. Hoffman does a bunch of armor, and then for some reason, a bunch of armor defeating capability. So obeying his dudes to beat up his other dudes ends up being pretty effective, and you can steal his resources while you do it to boot. And I very much think that a one-tricked Zoraida will get familiar enough with all of the matchups to know what to obey to ruin their lives. So I think there's a very high skill ceiling with that. But to the other three's credit, I've played one game into Next Kids, and I did not like how they could just throw greatswords at you while healing.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah. But I think that there is more to overpower with the next kids. Because if someone can just, you know, at the end of the day, they're defense 5, 7 health stone users, which is rad. But that's, as the Vix have demonstrated before Malifaux Burns, that is an eminently overcomable defensive suite. And so I think if they just, like, catch reds at the wrong time, or have someone who's prepared to just gun you down and watch you have to walk across the board to fight. I don't like their odds as much. Not to say that I'm the expert on Next Kids, and if, you know, they have ways to deal with that, then great. But at least on paper, to me, Next Kids can be defeated by a gun heavy crew. And that's not, you know, this one weird matchup that you know, 4 to 5 Dennis Tate. It sometimes people just bring guns.
I think they're going to bring him a lot more in GG3 too.
I agree with that. And so I don't know if
everything's in the center. There's like no reason to go across the board.
Right. Yeah. Well, at least until
the one strategy.
Four. Yeah. So to me, that does not smack of it is about to be the next kid's reign. And I'm always readily able to admit that I'm wrong about my predictions, but I don't think it's next kids. Now, Terra, even though she doesn't have card manipulation to a real degree, I mean, Yannick can kind of band-aid that a bit, but for the most part, I don't think Terra has the card manipulation that I like. Like, if Terra has the two kings in hand, then yeah, she's going to have a great time. And those 8 highs, like, her whole crew is just like, God, I wish I could guarantee anything going off.
Yeah. I'm intimately familiar with that.
Yeah.
Screaming at TNs.
Exactly. Yeah. And there are a lot of TNs. So, yeah. And
just being like, oh my God, they're in a forest and I need a 5. And yes. I have an attack action because all of my stuff is attack actions and not tacticals.
Just, yes.
All of that mess.
Yeah. When you're sitting there, I need to land the stutter time. I'm out of stones. It's the bottom of the 9th. The base is loaded. You're just like, I just can't watch this. So, yeah. To me, like, Terra's highs are fantastic, but her lows suck so much. Yeah. So to me, she's not the generalist master of your dreams. But
she's also really susceptible to jokers, like especially Terra 2. She has like all these TNs, and it's like you black one of them, you're just left with out to win.
Well, and her 3 favorite models are all enforcers, and she's not an arcanist. So if someone just has the tech to bring down those models, get bodied. Like, I've seen Talos impaled on the end of a Kaia spear multiple times now. And
nothing beast die to like the most random stuff.
And it sucks that you can't spend resources to compensate for it. And so to me, like, heavy reliance on enforcers that aren't like gods of surviving things, not for me. But like I said, like, her highs are high. Like, she, you know, I've got these 2 pass tokens now and my, you know, alpha cannon set up and I'm going to steal your guy and eat him. Like, yeah, those activations feel great. But, you know, anybody can win a game if their cards are really, really good and they know what they're doing. But when your cards are really, really bad and you know what you're doing, that's a different setup. So for me, she's out. But the last one, Yanlo 2. I think Yanlo 2 is really, really strong. Like, he has stuff that he can technically lose to. But I think if you are a to the nth degree Yanlo 2 player, you're going to be one of the most frustrating KG players to play into. And I think
I'm a control player at heart, too.
Yeah. And I think Yanlo plays really well with that. Like, at the end of the day, if you are not eminently prepared to be able to deal with Yanlo 2, just from like a playstyle perspective, because it's not even like necessarily like the right tech, right? Like, obviously being able to one-shot Kamini would be awesome, but for the most part, like, people have seen Armor 2 before, they've seen Hard to Kill before, and they have 5 wounds. Like, you can have Sun Quang in there and all that fun stuff, but like, you know, if the Kamini just stood there and did nothing, then like, you could kill him. Like, it's not impossible to kill, but once the Yanlo player starts playing the cagiest game you've ever seen, like, people just don't know how to deal with that. And I didn't even for the longest time. And then he's just got like little pieces of tech that just make it worth it. Like the remove up to 2 markers for cards thing.
It's like, just nuts.
Yeah. Well, it's like, the cards are great. The ability to be like, I really need these pyre markers not here anymore is great. The hole in the world is disgusting. It's one of the, I mean, short of like Into the Dream Web, I think it's the most distance displacing offensive attack I can think of. I don't even think Zip with You're Coming With Me triggered on Up We Go goes quite as far as it. And it's just, it's strong. It's so strong. And then stun on that as well. The Kamainu are just stupid fast while being cheap, which is going to be another big thing, I think, with this new GG, is it really wants you to have lots of difficult to kill cheap models that weren't summoned. And I think Kamainu fit that bill absolutely. So
that's where I think Nexus has a advantage in terms of the GG, just because, you know, you're bringing the 3 masters and then all of your, if you hire the insignificant models and they replace them, then they become significant that it wasn't summoned. So you can easily be rocking around with like, you know, 11 significant models and you still got like 2-3 beaters plus the, 2 beaters plus the little kids shooting little min 3s at you.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's their advantage. But like you said, yeah, their weakness is 2 guns.
Yeah, and I think the weakness of Next Kid's comparison to the weakness of Yanlo, like Yanlo's weaknesses are A, much more manageable for Yanlo, because his game is all about positioning and it's very hard to force him to position badly.
Yeah, position better is usually the you don't have to actually go to the list writing phase to correct most things.
Right. And so I think if you're going to one trick something, my vote is either Zoretta, because her match having great matchup knowledge is very strong, Zoretta, or Yanlo too, just to play the positioning game more offensively and defensively. If they can't get to you, it's really hard for them to attack you. So, and he's, like I said, he's got the models that I think are going to be the stars of GG3, which is those, I've been saying that the Necropunk is going to be the poster child of GG3, that kind of low cost, uncomfortably tanky scheme runner kind of stuff. And Kamainu, to me, obviously they have a little bit more offensive power than the Necropunks do, but it's that same basic pay grade of like uncomfortably tanky for cost, but able to get a lot of work done. And Yanlo too has that while being able to play his very strong positioning game. And then having the auto bay here and there is also just really strong. So yeah, those are my two votes.
Cool. All right. Anything else to add before we take off?
Oh, let's think about this. The Texas GT is coming up. So, you know, if you guys have time for that, it's in early October. We're having a belt buckle made obtuse, as we can only have it down here in Texas. I hope to see a lot of people come out. We've got hotels nearby, the whole nine yards. Other than that, long may the God
Houston, right?
That's correct.
I was looking into the ones you guys did last year, and I remember the flights were crazy cheap. I don't know if they're still crazy cheap, but worth looking into.
Yeah, no, definitely. I'm really excited for it. I'm hoping that we get to see a lot of big wigs come out and kick us in the face and take our prize money, but it'll be a good time.
All right. Well, thanks for chatting with me, Andre.
It was a pleasure.
What are you doing in my swamp?